Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You're listening to the Red Sea Podcast, part of the Over the Monster Network.
Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
Hosted by Jake Devereaux.
It's gone. It's into the bullpen. This game is tied. This game is tied. David Ortiz. David Ortiz. David Ortiz.
And featuring Keaton DeRosier.
It's a grand slam. I'm telling you.
Welcome back to episode 221 of the Red Seat Podcast. This is your host, Jake Devereaux, and today I am joined by my regular co-host, Keaton DeRosier of Over the Monster and the Dynasty Guru. Keaton, I had a little trouble there knowing what podcast I was on because I appeared on basically all of the podcasts last week.
Were you able to keep things straight? Did you ever forget which one you were on?
I was able to definitely keep it straight, especially when I was on the pre-cap, because I was by myself, so I was reminded by that. But, you know, it blurred together. I did the three-peat last week of OTM podcast. So the only one I was not on was the Over the Monster podcast, but I was on that one the week before. So I'm hitting up all the Over the Monster podcasts. So hopefully the listeners aren't getting sick of hearing me.
No, how could they?
I don't know. It sounds impossible. But how are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. Thank you for taking the pre-cap and talking about that terrible series against Tampa Bay so that Shelly and I could talk about the wonderful sweep of the Yankees. Appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. I'm always here to take that bullet for you, buddy. So Keaton alluded to it. We're going to be talking about the sweep of the Yankees today, what that means for the Red Sox, what that means for the Yankees. We're going to be talking about the pitching staff as well. Garrett Richards, a guy who we need to really start talking about. We're going to be talking about some roster moves, but we're going to spend the bulk of the show today highlighting some individual names that could become of interest to the Red Sox at the trade deadline. And these names are all not Max Scherzer. You guys have heard us talk a lot about Max Scherzer. We're not going to talk about them at all. These are all different names than you may have heard. They are all fairly realistic targets, we believe. So we're going to go into each and every one of these names, break down the pros and cons of these individuals, talk about whether or not it's very likely for the Red Sox to go out and acquire them. And we've separated it into a few different categories. So we'll be talking about starting pitcher targets, relief pitcher targets, outfield bats, middle infield bats, and corner infield bats. And these will answer a bunch of your listener questions, too. So we did get a bunch of listener questions, but, you know, the agenda of the show is actually going to cover many of them. So we'll call those out as we go. All right, let's get right into it, Keaton. You mentioned the great news. The Red Sox are off to a hot start this weekend after sweeping the Yankees. That leaves them in sole possession of first place in the AL East, second best record in the American League. Houston has a better record than them. San Francisco has a better record in the National League. They are tied with the LA Dodgers in terms of winning percentage. Red Sox had a really good weekend. I mean, that was awesome.
Yeah. Couldn't really get much better than that. Got great pitching, hitting some dingers. Hunter Renfroe is having the best year of his career, so that's nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. His defense has been on point. Garrett Whitlock was awesome in that series, pitching twice against the Yankees. Matt Barnes was pretty good. I think I was a little bit nervous during his second appearance, but things ended up working out. By and large, the bullpen came up pretty big.
Yeah.
In addition to the starting pitching.
Yeah, it did, especially bailing out Martin Perez, who only went like 3 2/3. And they finished that off, not allowing any runs. So yeah. That was an incredibly strong start. It was a lot to ask of those guys, and they got a ton.
Yeah, definitely. Red Sox are now undefeated versus the Yankees this season. They've won 7 straight, dating back to last year. My question for you, Keaton, is at this point in the season, with where these teams are at, the Yankees are 4th place in the division, 6.5 games behind the Red Sox. Can we officially stick a fork in the Yankees?
Ooh. Not yet.
What are we waiting for?
They still have a bunch of games against the Red Sox. And, I mean, they can make up... 6.5 is a decent-sized lead, but it's not something that can't be overcome. I mean, we're only halfway through the season. We're basically at the midpoint now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like upper 70s in games played. Or yeah, just about right at 80. And it's the Yankees, so I have a hard time writing them off until they're like pretty darn close to mathematically eliminated. Although struggles of guys like Garrett Cole are bad. Like it's 4.5 ERA over last month. Basically, since the MLB is like, we're gonna crack down on this stuff. Seems like that was a big part of his game. Not unlike Garrett Richards. So that puts a big biff in it, but they're also going to get Kluber back. There are other guys that have been on the shelf are presumably going to come back. They'll probably put up a fight, and they have a ton of games left against the Red Sox. I think they've played a lot against Tampa, so it might be more difficult for them to make up ground on Tampa, but there are still plenty of games against the Red Sox, and whatever the Red Sox or Yankees are doing in the standings, those games are always tough. So I'm not there yet.
I don't know. What is this, me being an optimism guy? But I'm going to stick a fork in the Yankees right now. I just think there's way too many problems on this team. And I totally get what you're saying. I still feel anxious during close Red Sox-Yankees games, even when I know the Yankees are an inferior team. But to me, there's just way too many problems on this club. I mean, looking at their lineup, everyone in that lineup is right-handed, except for Brett Gardner, who sucks at baseball now. You can't have that many right-handed bats in a Yankees lineup. It's an old team. It's an underperforming team. The bullpen is good. The starting pitching is just as suspect, if not more suspect, than any of the other AL East teams. Garrett Cole legitimately looks like a number 2 or 3 starter now that he's not using spider tack. If I'm them, I'm crapping my pants about the fact that I have to pay this guy through, what, how many years do they have him? He's locked up through 2028. Oh my word. Through 2028, they have to pay this guy to pitch without spider tack, and he's going to get paid $36 million per year. And they're going to be paying Giancarlo Stanton, who has many problems of his own, through 2028 as well. It's or 2027. It's crazy the amount of money they have locked up into these guys that are now looking like massive question marks.
Yeah, but I mean, there are also questions about the Blue Jays, the Rays, and the Red Sox too. So I guess that's where I'm more hesitant to write them off. I mean, you're 100% right about all those issues. But there are still question marks about Red Sox starting pitching. There are times where the offense has been inconsistent, although significantly better than what the Yankees are dealing with. The bullpen, Matt Barnes, is really the only one that we can really feel comfortable. Well, again, Garrett Whitlock, too. I'll include those two guys are like the only two like locks there in the bullpen. These are areas that we're going to also discuss as ways to upgrade via trade. But I think there's not a sure thing with those top four teams. The Red Sox have clearly been the most consistent, and that puts them, you know, squarely in, or at least for the moment, in sole possession of first place. But there's still too much baseball left for things to be able to change. Like, I mean, we've seen teams go on like massive swings. Like 2019, the Nationals were like 22-29, and then ended up winning the World Series, ended up turning it around, having a wild second half. Like, the Yankees absolutely have flaws, but they could also be one of those teams that just all of a sudden play 650 ball over the second half after the All-Star break and put themselves back into it, especially with a bunch of games against the Red Sox. So yeah, I'm more hesitant. I mean, I'm not saying I believe that it's going to happen. Right. There's too much baseball left, and we've seen weirder things happen that I'm just not ready to write them off completely.
Yeah, that's fair. I have such a hard time overlooking the fact that this is a Yankees team that can't score. And that's the thing that freaks me out about this Yankees team, and it's awesome to see. But, you know, the only two teams that they've scored more runs than in the American League are the Detroit Tigers and the Baltimore Orioles.
Low bar.
Yeah. I mean, and Red Sox are second in the American League in runs behind the dynamic Houston Astros. So it's really a tale of two teams in regards to that. So it's going to be interesting. I love to see it. It's really nice after just so many years of freaking out about the Yankees. You know, I spent my whole childhood, you know, looking up in the standings against the Yankees. So it's very nice to be in this position at this point. And also, like, you know, talk in the preseason, it was all about how the Yankees were going to win this division by like 10 games. You know, no one was even giving the Rays a chance with the fact that they got rid of Snell and they lost Charlie Morton and blah, 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 blah. It is just really funny how things have worked out.
Yeah. Like how the Giants have the best record in baseball. It's been a weird year.
It's been a very weird year. All right, so over this past week, since we last spoke on the 21st, Red Sox have really turned things around in the starting pitching department, and I think that's where we've seen sort of the biggest gains and led to their success over the past week. Nick Pivetta carried a no-hitter through almost to the seventh inning, or almost through the seventh inning. Nady Eovaldi pitched into the eighth inning against the Yankees and looked incredible. Erod, incredibly strong performance against Gerrit Cole. My question to you, Keaton, is out of these last three performances this week from Pivetta, Eovaldi, and Erod, which one of these impressed you most?
Oh, it's got to be Pivetta. 6 2/3 of no-hit ball. That's got to be it. It was really great to see Erod turn it around after having such a string of poor starts and just pitch super well. And Eovaldi had kind of been scuffling a bit, but it seems like he's put a couple good starts in a row. It's certainly been a weird year for pitching, but I never thought Nick Pivetta would be on the no-hitter alerts on the MLB app. So that one was shocking. And not only that, it was against Tampa Bay in a game that they needed to win to get first place back from Tampa. So,
big spot. Good offense, too.
Good offense, big spot, and crushed it.
Yeah, he was awesome. And the thing that's been really good about Pivetta is just how well his fastball has been playing this year. It's a true weapon for him. And I was really encouraged to see that Pivetta has not been one of these guys that's been really adversely affected, you know, by this whole crackdown on sticky stuff. I've been watching closely all of the Red Sox starters since it happened, and I've been looking for them to bounce back with good performances. And, you know, this Pivetta thing lets me know he can do this against the top offense. So, I mean, he had been the guy that I've been most skeptical about in this rotation. When we did our rankings like a month ago of how much we trusted these guys, I had him fifth. I mean, I would have him easily top three now.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. Well, didn't you pointed out, now I can't remember who was it against. Was it Zach Wheeler? And you were like, Pivetta just snatched his stole and has been pitching on a tear ever since.
That was against Jacob DeGrom.
Yeah, that was it. DeGrom. That's the one.
No. I'm sorry. It was Garrett Richards who was against DeGrom. Whose stole did Pivetta snatch? Maybe it was Zach Wheeler's stole. Maybe you were right the first time. I can't remember.
Either way, he's been pitching above himself ever since, and you've pointed to having confidence of going toe-to-toe with the other aces around the league, or not, well, not other aces, but aces in general,
right,
around the league, and consistently coming out better than, that's got to give you a ton of confidence, and when you're pitching like that, you know, that's certainly a plus.
Yeah, it really is, and, you know, the stuff looks every bit as good as he thinks it is, which is always nice. And his breaking ball's been really solid as well. I wasn't that surprised by Nathan Eovaldi's start. He's been a Yankee killer over the last couple of years, so I was very impressed, don't get me wrong, but I kind of expected that from Nathan Eovaldi. I'm not going to say I expected him to work into the eighth inning, but I expected him to deliver a really good start there. But I think it was Erod who impressed me the most, just because what we'd seen from him this year has been so ridiculously up and down. And to go in and do that in that spot to get the sweep was just, that was huge.
Yeah, and going up against Gerrit Cole, which is still an intimidating opponent. Even with the recent struggles that he's had, Gerrit Cole's still a name, still a guy that has really good stuff, whether, you know, spin rates are down or not. Maybe he's slightly less imposing, but that's still, especially going up against the Yankees with the win streak on the line against them, and to pitch the way that he did, that was a big spot.
Yeah, it was huge. How would you rank these guys going forward now?
Eovaldi, Erod, Pivetta.
Yeah. I'm with you. I think that's the right order. All right, it's time we should talk about Martin Perez. He looked a little bit better against the Yankees and in his last couple starts than he did in his first couple of the, you know, no sticky stuff time period. What was your impression of how he looked versus the Yankees? I mean, he wasn't overpowering or anything, but he was able to work around some jams.
He was. I don't think he looked that great. Only 3 2/3, and he walked two, gave up 6 hits.
But no earned runs.
No. Well, yeah. I mean, the only reason they weren't earned was because of the error, obviously. But which is kind of another thing. The Red Sox, in their last 10 games coming into tonight, there's 11 errors. That's not the first time we've had to talk about the defense. So that may be for another segment, but and just because they were unearned doesn't make me feel like he had that much better of a performance.
I guess I was more encouraged by it. That on the back of the 5 innings against Kansas City at Kansas City, where he only allowed 1 earned run, because the 2 starts against Houston and Toronto were so bad. I mean, 2 innings and 1 1/3 innings, those last 2 starts, and then to see him bounce back there, it at least gave me confidence that, like, as a number 5 starter, it will play.
Yeah, I guess with that expectation, that's true.
Maybe he's probably not going to... go ahead.
I was going to say, he's probably not going to get back to the, I guess, the pre-sticky stuff era, we'll say, or MLB checks, maybe. Although his... we talked about how, I mean, Garrett Richards clearly is having spin rate issues, but everybody else, including Martin Perez, not really. I mean, he had experienced some drops in his spin rates, but nothing that was too crazy. And then in the last start against the Yankees, they were right back up to where they normally were. So I thought that maybe he might have been injured, because that's typically seeing that drop in spin rates. But it was like a steady decline over 4 starts. It wasn't just an immediate drop. So I thought maybe there was something else in there. And to see him right back up to where his season averages have been in that last start is certainly encouraging. he was also pitching extremely well through the first 2.5 months of the season, three months of the season, 2.5 months mm-hmm. of the season. So maybe we'll get back to that, but if, I mean, he doesn't need to if he's going to be the fifth starter. He just needs to be able to get to the fifth inning every time. So however he has to do that, that's fine.
Yeah, and I think it is also worth noting that he's only had 3 games this year with a higher game score than his start against Kansas City, which is his second most recent start. So he can pitch to the pre-sticky checks level, or maybe not quite as high as, like, you know, the 76 game score that he threw at Houston with 7 2/3 innings. But, you know, a 60 is solid. That's a really solid game score, especially coming off a game score of 1 versus Toronto and 12 versus Houston. So not super great there. But yeah, I'm happy to see him reach that height again. I definitely feel pretty confident about him, and I agree with you, Keaton. I was watching the spin rates for him, and I was really happy that he was able to get those back up to where we wanted them to be. So that's huge. Oh, Hunter Renfroe home run as we are on the podcast. Nice.
He sure did. Game is tied.
Is it? No, they're down by 1 still.
But, no, I think you're way behind, man.
Oh no. Yeah, my internet's slow right now. Oh, that stinks.
I said they scored that fifth run like 5 minutes ago.
All right. So it's time to talk about Garrett Richards, though. He is the one pitching in this game right now. He does not look good, to say the least. I do not have an up-to-date box score for him, apparently, because my internet's being weird. But do you have a line for him for this game?
Yeah, he's still the pitcher for the Red Sox. So he's through 4, 5 runs, 3 homers. Whatever you're seeing, that should be accurate for
1 strikeout.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I do have the accurate game score or updated for him. This is really troubling. So we got a listener question that I'm going to address right now.
No walks though. So you know.
Yeah, I guess so. a great big Lark has a couple questions for us tonight. But one of them is, if Richards looks awful again tonight, do you think this is his last start? If Houck is ready to be called up in a week, do you think the Red Sox have enough bullpen depth to do a bullpen game every 5 days for 2 to 3 weeks? I think that I have seen enough from Garrett Richards at this point with this game as well. He gave up 5 in this one so far. This one could get worse. The 3 home runs were absolute shots. I mean, it's just, he doesn't look good to me. He hasn't looked good in a while. He's giving non-competitive starts at this point. I am ready to give him the Phantom IL stint and call up Tanner Houck, even if that means that you're only getting like 3 to 5 innings from Houck when he comes up. I think the bullpen is built to handle that right now. And at this point, like, Garrett Richards is putting you in a hole every time he goes out there.
Yeah, this is where the Red Sox need to step in and just save him from itself at this point, because he can't be learning new pitches and testing them out at the major league level in competitive games. That's not going to help you as an organization. You're like, Phantom IL stint immediately, so he can actually, like, on the side with pitching coaches, work through this, figure it out, give him a couple rehab starts in AAA to see if he's actually comfortable with it, if it's going to take, and then try and slot him back in there again at the major league level. Or if it doesn't work, then DFA Matt Andrees, and he's the new Matt Andrees, the guy that just comes in games you're already losing and pitches until it's over, no matter how bad he gets hit. Because rolling him out while you're trying to win a division now is just not going to work while he's trying to learn new grips and new pitches at the major league level. That's like, there's a reason why players do that in spring training, and then if it doesn't work, abandon it. Like, it's not something you can do at the major league level every fifth day.
Yeah, and one of my problems with Garrett Richards, and I've talked about this with Shelley a little bit, it doesn't seem to me like he's super committed to learning how to pitch without this stuff. It seems like he's still in this mode of throwing kind of a tantrum about the MLB doing this and like taking it personally and blah, 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 blah. He's not the only guy this sucks for. And bottom line is you need to adapt and figure out how to help your team. And to me, I just don't think he's doing that. What are your thoughts on that piece?
I think that he is, but I'm basing that off of like what we've heard from Cora. And like you talked before the game today about Garrett Richardson, they said that they were happy with the progress that he had made in putting in effort to try and learn new grips and work around this. And he was looking forward to Richards taking some steps forward tonight. Obviously the ball's flying out of the yard, but he has at least not given up a run in his last seven outs. So that's a plus, or eight outs. So that's a plus. But, yeah, terrible first two innings. The last two innings have been all right. Still only the one strikeout. That's pretty tough. But yeah. No walks is nice to see.
Yeah, I guess if you're really looking for a silver lining there, I mean, his effectiveness has just gone down, and it seems like it's more than just the spin rates. It seems like it's mental to me. Since the crackdown on spin rates, his game scores have been 37, 27, 9, and then this gem tonight so far, which will be slightly better than the 9, but not very good. yeah. But those are all, I mean, aside from the very first start of the season where he also had his spin rates completely off, those will be his worst four starts of the season. So it's just, dude needs to go figure it out. And Tanner Houck looks pretty ready. I mean, he's thrown a couple innings or outings, I should say, at AAA, looked really good, struck out six in each of those. I feel confident with him coming up and how his stuff will play at the major league level.
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen him be really good at the major league level and against really good offenses. So I don't know why we wouldn't have confidence in that.
Yeah. So if you're Cora, you make that move right away.
Well, he just got a second strikeout of the night, so maybe I'm starting to buy back in. I'm not kidding. I'm not serious about that.
Oh, okay.
No.
That's all it took. The bar's low.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I think even so, let's say he finishes off this inning and maybe even pitches another and gets through it. It still wasn't a great outing, and it's still like, are you going to expect him to be that efficient in his next start? I wouldn't expect it. Yeah, that's I keep coming back to, he can't keep experimenting on these things at the major league level when they're trying to win the division.
Right.
Like, they're not doing themselves any favors with that. So I just don't understand how you couldn't make that move and at least, like, give Houck a chance. I mean, Garrett Richards is making too much money. He's not going to go away completely. He's going to be on the major league roster in some form or fashion. But if he can't figure this out enough to be a starter for you, then you got to move him to the bullpen and, you know, save him from himself and just see if he can figure it out in the offseason for someone else.
Yep, I agree. Before we get to our main segment of the night, talking about this trade stuff, a little bit of a minor roster move since the last time we had this podcast. Connor Wong did get the call-up for Kevin Plawecki, which was a little bit of a surprise, but I actually think he looked pretty good calling the game the other day. And Michael Chavis is up for Christian Arroyo. So, Keaton, which one of these are you celebrating more, your boy or being right about Connor Wong?
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that I was right about Connor Wong because you pointed out that he was not having a great AAA debut.
No.
So that was kind of surprising. But then again, I mean, they're not relying on him on an everyday role here. So maybe that's not that bad. But of course, it's my boy Chavis.
I'd expect nothing else from you than to be excited about Chavis. So that's good. All right. So let's get right to our main segment of the night. We are going to be talking about trade targets. We had a question from A Great Big Lark, It says, as much as I love hearing about pipe dream trades with the Nationals, do you think Bloom? What do you think Bloom will actually do at the deadline? Feels like he will be content doing small trades to tighten up the bullpen, maybe a 3-4 starter. What do you think? Again, not wanting to hear our optimal scenario about Max Scherzer, but maybe a more realistic trade scenario. We also got a question from Jay Pick. I'm not 100% sure what your actual Twitter name is, but he says, what would the prospect cost be for impending free agent Starling Marte taking Santana's roster spot as a leadoff center fielder? Can't imagine the Marlins holding on to him and paying him $5 million from August to September just for the qualifying offer compensation. So he is one of the guys we are going to address tonight, Starling Marte. As well, we're going to talk about starting pitching first, because I think, Keaton, are we both in agreement that starting pitching is probably the biggest area of need for this team?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So I have collected 8 players who may be available. I'm going to run through those names real quick, and then we can discuss these names. The names are Caleb Smith, a lefty. For Arizona, he has 2 more arbitration years left, including this one. So you'd be getting him for about a season and a half if you were to trade for him. Arizona is terrible. Charlie Morton, a free agent after this year, 2021. He's owed $15 million. He's for the Braves, and the Braves are not having a very good year. Herman Marquez, a name we've talked about before, 26 years old. He is arbitration eligible, or not arbitration eligible. He is signed from 2021 through 2023 with a 2024 team option. John Gray, also a Colorado Rocky like Marquez. He's a free agent after this year. Kyle Gibson, who is somehow leading the league in ERA. He is signed through 2022, so you'd be getting him for a year and a half. Jose Berrios, another guy, a year and a half of control left. His last RB year is 2022. Kenta Maeda is signed through 2023. Both of those guys are Twins. That club is struggling mightily. And he has a very cheap salary of about $3 million. And then Danny Duffy is another option. He is the one who's pitching against the Red Sox right now. He's a lefty. He's got $15.5 million due to him this year. He's a free agent after this season. Royals probably don't have him in their plans going forward. So, and they probably don't, they're probably not super thrilled about paying him that money. Out of these 8 guys, do you have any that interest you more than others?
Yes. Caleb Smith.
Okay.
He is having a really good year so far this year. And like you pointed out, he has 2 more years of control after this. He's also only making $1.4 million. This year, so that would be prorated down to whatever it is at the time that they would have acquired him. But this is the key to me. The Red Sox, as it stands right now, have $1.2 million to spare before they hit the luxury tax. Seems like they don't want to go over for this year's team. Otherwise, I feel like they may have put in a little bit more effort in the offseason to on a couple of the guys that we talked about. Like all off season that we were hoping they would kind of make some changes, and they didn't make a splash in the off season. They're obviously in first place right now, so they probably don't feel like they need to make a major splash. I'm hoping that is not the case and they want to add someone, but adding a guy like Caleb Smith who has a lot of control and is not making a lot wouldn't put them over the threshold, would give the starting pitching an immediate boost that they need. While also qualifying what I assume are the financial restrictions that they are kind of dealing with. Not that I don't expect the Red Sox to ever go over the luxury tax again. Like I've said a million times on this podcast, this is the off season where there's just a buttload of free agents that are game-changing free agents, and the Red Sox have a bunch of money and potential money coming off the books. And so this upcoming off season is the one that you and I basically have pegged since like the end of 2019, right? As the one where we saw them potentially spending a bunch of money and going over. Yep. I don't think that they would, being basically this close to that offseason, I don't think they're looking to make a move to put them over right now. Maybe I'm wrong, but It still seems like the financials are a concern for them. And Caleb Smith, they would be able to acquire with staying under the luxury tax for now, which I think would be a major boost to him. So not only is he a good player, I think he fits the financials and all the yada yadas. And so I think he would be a great fit for this team. And Arizona is just an absolute mess. So I don't think it would take a ton to convince them to move him.
Yeah, he's a really interesting guy because, you know, he's had some good seasons too in the past, particularly in his time with Miami. He had some enticing seasons where he looked pretty good. He's got a 3.03 ERA so far this year. He's still only 29, but he's pitching to a 1.35 ERA plus by Baseball Reference, and you know 100 is league average with that. So he's been 35% better than league average. And I think you nailed it with the money part, Keaton. That would be very, very easy for them to figure out. So I'm very interested in that one. Let's go down the line here a little bit. Charlie Morton, he's having a really resurgent year for the Braves. The Braves don't have the deepest system in the world. And if they truly feel like they are out of it, especially with the news that, you know, they're not going to be getting Soroka back this year, I could see them doing something there where they could make this deal affordable and probably get them to, you know, take some or maybe all of the money or send somebody back, or I don't know. But I feel like they've already paid a bunch of that contract, half of that contract. I feel like there are ways that they might be able to get that done. What are your thoughts on Charlie Morton for a year or half year?
Yeah, that one is interesting because, I mean, talk about, like, not having to give up much. Charlie Morton, we all thought, was going to retire after last year, and then obviously it was all the COVID stuff, got pushed, and then it was a weird shortened year, and he decided to come back again for what would be a full season. So again, like, I don't think it would cost much at all if Atlanta's like, you know what, doesn't think it's happening for us. Because the expectation would be that you would just get him for 2 months and that's it, and then it's done.
Right.
So it would cost next to nothing to acquire him, and he's having a pretty good year. So if they can work out the financial pieces for it, I think this is a great target for the Red Sox.
Yeah, I would almost rather give like an extra prospect or two to have them stay under the CBT and maybe have Atlanta carry, you know, all but, you know, $1.5 million of his salary or whatever. To keep them under that level. However, if they couldn't do that, if they had to go over the first threshold of the CBT, I wouldn't hate that for a guy like Morton, who I think could really be a game changer when it comes to the playoffs, especially if you can get a guy like Chris Sale back in the rotation by playoff time. I wouldn't worry about that too much because I think that there are things that they could do on this team, like not bringing back Garrett Richards and Martin Perez next year on those club options that could put them under the threshold again next year. So I'm actually not really panicking too much about going over by a small amount this year because I think you can pretty easily figure out a way to reset next year.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. Yeah, I mean, they have a bunch of stuff coming off the books, so they should be able to at least make one or two really interesting signings if they do go over by a little bit.
Yeah, Adam Ottavino, he's owed almost $9 million. He's coming off the books, too. Erod's coming off at 8.3. They've got a lot of big guys coming off.
Potentially J.D. Martinez as well.
Yeah, especially with the year he's having.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess I would give them a lot more as long as, like you said, it's not like a major investment. They're going way over.
Well, I guess the biggest question here then is, do they sell Morton at this point, considering where they are in the standings? Do you think that that's, you know, a possibility?
Because
he's 37.
Yeah, I mean, I probably would. I mean, they're under 500 right now, but the NL East is such a weird division.
I know. I almost didn't put any of the NL East teams as sellers because I feel like any of them could still win that division. So I'm just not convinced that they are going to be sellers, even with them being, what are they, fourth place in the division at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess third place.
They're 1 percentage point or 1/1000th of a percentage point out of the Phillies.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they got a month to figure it out, right? I mean, if in a month from now, if they're like 2.5 back, if they've made up half of their ground, they're probably not. They'll probably make a push. But if they fall back the other way and they're closer to 10 games out, then yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch. All right, moving down the list here to the two Rockies guys, Germán Márquez and John Gray. Any interest in these two?
I have no interest whatsoever in John Gray. I don't understand how this is possible, but he's worse outside of Coors. I don't think I've ever seen a pitcher that's worse outside of Coors than they are in Coors, except maybe that one season that Yovaldo Jimenez was like a god, or that half a season he was a god. Like, particularly this year, like his career numbers, his ERA is worse out of Coors. It's even more drastic this year. He has a 3.25 ERA in Coors, 5.32 outside.
Hmm.
I don't know how that's possible, but that's like, this is a guy that, you know, has been mentioned as like, oh my God, is he finally putting it together? Former top draft pick from a few years ago. And every time I dig into his numbers, I'm just baffled and confused and want nothing to do with him.
Yeah. I totally agree with you on John Gray. And the other piece of this is that with the other Rockies guy, Germán Márquez, who we've talked about, even though he's 26 years old and he's relatively affordable through 2024, I don't really want to give up the prospect package that it would take to go get him from the Rockies. I mean, I would explore it and kick the tires on it and see if the Rockies want to do something dumb. But yeah, I agree with you. I'm not convinced John Gray is any better than just Tanner Houck. In fact, I'm pretty convinced he's not. Germán Márquez, though, I think is better. But the cost could be pretty prohibitive there.
Yeah, and like a normal person, he's much better outside of Coors. and that would be the difficult piece of trying to pry him from the Rockies, is that they're going to want a lot in return for a guy who will be much better wherever he goes and still has, like, what was it, this year plus two more years of control?
Yeah, and then a 2024 team option as well, which is relatively inexpensive. So you'd think that whoever trades for him would exercise that.
Yep, that's going to be tough.
Yeah. All right, how about Kyle Gibson? He's been a bit of an enigma throughout his career. Wasn't very good with the Twins, but has been pitching absolutely out of his mind. He had the horrible first start this season, but since then has been pretty much the best pitcher in the American League. What do you make of him? He's controlled for $7.5 million through 2022, so that would be a solution for next year as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Texas sucks. Texas does suck. That is true. It's weird, right? I mean, the big thing is he's not giving up home runs this year, which has been a major problem for him in the past. I don't know what to make of him. It's weird, but Texas, like, it's clearly no point in them holding on to him because they're not going anywhere. They're better served if they trade him for some form of prospect packages, so... Yeah, if that's, again, is something where, like, the financials could work, and then you have him for another year to see if he's able to put back-to-back seasons like this together, which he has never done in his career before. For the majority of his career, he's been pretty bad. But capitalize on this what you can, sure.
Yeah, I'm not really convinced he's going to be able to do this outside of Texas. Texas is a really pitcher-friendly ballpark right now, too. And it just feels like there's nothing that he's done in his career that tells me that this is something that he can sustain. So I would be cool with it. See if he can catch lightning in a bottle. And I think, you know, he could definitely be a 4 or 5 starter, even if he comes back to earth. But I'm not paying through the nose to get a guy like this. The price would have to be right for Gibby.
Yeah. Agreed.
The Twins, probably the most unexpectedly bad team this year. They are tied with the Royals in record right now, and just seem to be going nowhere. They're 10 games below 500. They have two starters who are really interesting. Jose Berrios, who was their highly touted prospect, and he is he's got a year and a half left of team control. And then Kenta Maeda, who's got 2.5 years left of team control. He's 33 years old, having a down year, but he only makes $3 million a year, which is really interesting for him. And he was second place in the AL Cy Young voting last year. Do you like either of those guys?
So initially, yeah, I liked both. But Berrios has actually just been a guy that's, like, never fully put it together, and has, like, continued to show promise and then kind of not put it together. And it's kind of, like, one of those things where after, like, 5 seasons of this, is this just who he is? Or can he actually, like, be unlocked if he goes somewhere? But because of that, he's also kind of expensive, and I don't think – it's making $5.6 million this year. Has a year of arbitration next year. So I think it would be difficult to get him. Maeda, though, is remarkably cheap and is someone that I think is a good pitcher, even though he's having like the weird year this year. So I wouldn't mind trying to make the financials work there. And it wouldn't take much for it to work, because whatever the prorated is, it probably would work within you know, that threshold that they're dealing with right now. And then to have him that cheap for the next 2 years, like, I would much rather have him making $3 million than Martin Perez and Garrett Richards making, like, a combined, was it 16, 17?
Yeah. Almost 17, yeah. This is my favorite of all of these possibilities, is Kenta Maeda by far. You know, there's just so much more evidence of him being a very high level pitcher throughout his career than what he's doing this year, which is just weird. I mean, he has that 4.85 ERA. It feels very unlucky. He's also not been super healthy this year. He's been dealing with all sorts of different ailments over his body. I'm not even going to say they're like all connected. They're all just like random injuries that he's been getting. And I think, like, you know, you get this guy. If you can get Kenta Maeda to a level where he's feeling healthy by the time the playoffs roll around, that could be a game changer. And like you said, Keaton, having that cheap of a salary for him really opens up so many possibilities for the future.
Yeah. Yeah, it would. I'd be all in on that one.
Yeah. So, I mean, you'd be getting him for years 34, 35, 36. That doesn't really freak me out too much, especially because he's had relatively low innings totals while he's been in the major leagues, dating back to his first year in 2016.
Yeah, well, the Dodgers kept using him as like primarily reliever to keep his costs down.
Right.
And that ended up just benefiting the Twins. So why not have it benefit us?
Yep. And then last guy here, Danny Duffy. Any interest in Duffy?
So he's super weird, because I don't think he's very good, but he's having an incredible year. Well, I guess with the exception of tonight, where he's given him 3 homers and 4 runs to the Red Sox. But besides that, I mean, he's a 1.83 ERA. FIP and XFIP are about double that, but that's not all that bad. But for the majority of his career, he's been more of like a 4-4-2, 4-3 kind of guy. So I don't really know what to make of him. I guess I would rather pass, because I just don't know what to think of him. And if we're going to make a move, I'd rather be more sure of it. Striking out way more people than, like, he's 2.5 K per nine ahead of his career average this season. I don't get that.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
I don't really trust it, and the fact that he makes $15.5 million this year means that the financials are going to be kind of tricky anyway with this one. So yeah, that would be kind of last place for me, maybe tied with John Gray
for these ones that I'm not super interested. If I had to rank my top three, though, out of these starting pitching possibilities, taking everything into account, I would rank it Kenta Maeda 1, I would have Charlie Morton 2, and Caleb Smith 3. How would you have it?
I would flip Smith and who was the second one that you said?
Morton.
That one. Yep. I'd flip.
Okay. Yeah. Nice. All right. Let's move on to relief pitcher here. I had four relief pitcher targets. First one was Yimi Garcia, who is a free agent after 2021. The closer for the Marlins. They are last place in their division. They look to actually be kind of far out of it, so that's an interesting one. They should probably be sellers. Ian Kennedy, a free agent after 2021, also the closer for Texas. Again, free agent after 2021, so he is relatively cheap, probably having a good year. Kendall Graveman, closer, part closer, I guess, for the Mariners. They are kind of interesting because they're third place right now, so I'm not 100% sure they sell, but I don't think they believe they can win that division. So they're probably going to sell since he's a free agent after 2021. And then Daniel Bard. If that name sounds familiar, it's because that's the same Daniel Bard that we used to have. He's a free agent after 2022, which is his last arbitration year. He's not having a very good season, but I thought that one was kind of fun, so I put it in there.
Yeah. It also could be the Coors effect with him having kind of a down year. But all four of these guys are actually really interesting, and they're not making much money. So they would all work, probably. Like, you could work to acquire one of these guys and one of the starting pitchers that we talked about for this year and have it work, and I think that would be just the upgrades that the entire pitching staff needs.
Do you have any preference, or how would you rank these four starting relief pitchers in terms of how much you would like to acquire them?
Kennedy and Graveman, I would say like 1A, 1B, and then Garcia and Bard.
Graveman and Bard?
No. Kennedy and Graveman, 1A, 1B.
Got you. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I would probably have it Garcia, Graveman, then Kennedy, then Bard. That would probably be my ranking of these guys.
Interesting. But so Garcia is your number one?
Garcia is my number one, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I really like what he's done in Miami over the last couple of years. I definitely believe in him. But I also think that he could be the most expensive out of these rentals because of that performance. I kind of have a feeling like Kennedy might be the best deal out of all these guys, just in terms of the price.
Probably. Yeah, I mean, I think Kennedy and Graveman are both better than Garcia. So I would prefer to go after one of them. But, I mean, all three of those guys have been really good for, like, more than a year, and they're incredibly cheap.
Do you think they need to go after a reliever?
You know, if you asked me before the season started, I would have said yes. Like, significant, all caps, couple exclamation points. But it has not nearly been the disaster we expected, mainly because of Sawamura and Whitlock. Those additions have been tremendous.
Josh Taylor being a god.
Josh Taylor as well. Yeah. Not, you know, coming into the year, we didn't know what to expect with Sawamura. Taylor was just coming off of really bad 2020 and started off the season awful. Ed Whitlock, Rule 5 guy, wasn't expecting anything at all. So I'm much more confident in this bullpen than I was in the beginning of the year, for sure. But you can't have, like, too many good relief pitchers on your team, especially if they're going to make a push for the playoffs. Hunter Renfroe just hit his second home run of the night, by the way.
Nice.
God,
he's yeah, good. I feel like if they go out and address starting pitcher, let's just say they pick up Maeda or Morton or Smith, one of the guys that we like. Yeah. I don't feel like they have to go get a relief pitcher. I would like them to. However, I don't feel like it's a need. But if they don't address starting pitcher, I feel like they need to add a reliever.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
All right, let's get to some bats here before we answer our final few listener questions and get out of here. Outfield bats. This is the one that I think is probably the most unrealistic of them to address. Not that it's not a need. I just think it's probably the lowest end need of the needs on the team right now, especially with Jaron Duran looming. But four names that I put down here that are kind of interesting. Starling Marte, he's a free agent after 2021. He would be a perfect leadoff hitter, as the listener question pointed out. David Peralta as a free agent after 2022 for a bad Arizona club. He's having a pretty good year. Mitch Haniger is a free agent after 2022, having a great resurgent year, which is nice to see for Seattle. And Joey Gallo is having a bit of a tough year, actually, for Texas offensively, but still has just gobs of power, plays good defense. He is also controlled through 2022. Are you interested in bringing any of those guys into the Red Sox?
I mean, yes. Marte, I think, would be great. So, same with Joey Gallo. And Joey Gallo also has experience playing the corners as well as the outfield, as well as DH. So you kind of play with him in a bunch of different ways. Maybe even play him at first if Dalbach's still struggling. I think all of these guys are going to be really tough with the, like you said, it's a low priority. And then some of these guys like Marte is due, well, he's making $12.5 million this year. Obviously, that would be prorated to like probably around five-ish. And that's probably too much of a gap for the Red Sox. Gallo's making 6.2. They could probably make that up, but they're also probably going to have to give up some of their better prospects. Gallo's only 27 and still a pretty good baseball player. Yep. So I think because it's a low priority and a price, probably not going to happen. Peralta's been like stinky good for like 5 years now.
I really like him. He's a professional hitter.
Yeah, and then again, Haniger had a string of really good seasons with Seattle. It's just Duran being right there and maybe Franchi having a bit of a resurgence in AAA. I don't think it's a position that they're looking at all.
Yeah, and I honestly think Haniger might be a culture guy for Seattle, too, that they just keep, even though they don't really need him.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I kind of agree with you, Keaton. I don't think they end up addressing this one because of Duran, because of Price, and because of... Yeah, I guess those are the two main things here. And prospect cost. Like, getting Haniger, Gallo, or Marte is going to cost you some prospects. I think Peralta's the cheapest out of these guys from prospect cost. But, like, he's still a fixture in Arizona. You know, he's still, like, all of these guys are kind of clubhouse leaders, too.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
So, a little bit of an extra wrinkle there. Let's talk about our middle infield targets. I only put two guys here. Adam Frazier of the Pittsburgh Pirates, who's having just an incredible season. He is arbitration eligible through 2022. And then Eduardo Escobar, who's having a great season for the Arizona Diamondbacks. He's a free agent after 2021. Eduardo is making about $7.5 million, and Frazier, I believe, is somewhere around $4 million for this year. So Frazier's definitely the guy who you could probably fit in cost-wise a little bit more, although I bet Arizona would be willing to be super flexible for prospects coming back for Eduardo Escobar. Do you like either of these guys?
So I like Frazier a lot. Second base, as we have been saying for a while, is kind of a hole right now, and he could be your leadoff guy. He's looking at a season probably with, like, first off, he has a 401 OBP, which is like twice as high as an OBP that we've had batting in a leadoff spot all year. So that's nice. And he's on pace for like a 10 homer, 10 steal season, which would be incredibly good in this Red Sox lineup, and just his ability to get on base ahead of the guy sitting 2 through 5 would just be so great. I think it would be a perfect fit for this team.
How worried are you that this 331 is BABIP fueled, though? Because he has a BABIP that's about 60 points higher than his. Well, it's a little bit more than 60 points, 66 points higher than his career average. Or, oh no, 54 points. Yeah.
I mean, that's still a jump, but I mean, he's shown an ability to hit for average previously, like consistently hit 280. So even if you're getting 280 from him, the OBP is going to be significantly better than anything you have in a leadoff spot or hitting second. So even if there is some regression to it, it's still going to be better than what you have on the roster right now.
Yeah, I like him. I really like him. And I like that he's a lefty bat, too. There's a lot to like there. I think if the price is right, I'd be kind of thrilled about Adam Frazier, because I do agree with you. He definitely fills the leadoff position automatically. I'd be a little bit less excited about Eduardo Escobar. I'd still be happy with him, and I think he'd be a huge upgrade, definitely. But I'm not sure they need the power boost.
You know, yeah.
They've got a lot of power. I feel like Frazier fits the need better.
Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah, Eduardo Escobar is just giving you that power piece, and I don't think you really need it. Also, they're... both Chicago teams are already in a bidding war for him.
Yeah.
And I don't think you have the pieces to outbid either of them to acquire.
No.
So his him being a little bit tougher to fit financially and already having a high price, we're good.
Yeah, the other wrinkle that might help you in terms of Adam Frazier is that Charrington is in charge over there. So Charrington knows many of the players in this system, and it might be a little bit easier to strike a deal that way.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to our last part here. Corner infield bats. I picked two guys here. CJ Cron, who's having a great season for the Rockies. He's a free agent after 2021, is making next to nothing. So that would be a very easy guy to acquire. And then Jesus Aguilar, who's one of the league leaders in RBIs for Miami. He's making a little over $4 million, and he is a free agent after 2021. Would you be interested in either of those guys splitting time at first base?
Interesting. No. Mainly because I don't think it, like outfield, I don't think it's a major need. Like, they've got like five guys who can play first base. I think both of these guys would be upgrades, but not enough of an upgrade that I'd be willing to, you know, spend pieces on acquiring them.
Yeah, I'm like mostly there with you, but the thing is, CJ Cron is pretty good, and I think he's better than Bobby Dalbec right now. So I guess it depends on like how much you want to give Bobby Dalbec the reins for the rest of the year. It might be the wrong message to send Bobby Dalbec by going out there and acquiring CJ Cron right now, because Dalbec has been so much better over the last, you know, month or so. So I feel like he's trending in the right way, right direction. So that's the only thing that makes me a little bit hesitant.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'd rather just stick with Dalbec, giving him some kind of run there, give him a bit of a leash.
Yeah, I think that's probably the move. So over his last 28 days, Bobby Dalbec is batting .250 with a .443 slugging percentage. So
got a dinger tonight.
Yep, and that does not include tonight's stats. So it feels like he's getting there. So I'm also standing pat there. So what would a good trade deadline look like for you using the guys that we've compiled on this list? What's kind of like the optimal trade deadline for you?
Ian Kennedy and Caleb Smith. I'd feel good about it.
Okay. I would probably go Quinta Maeda, Yimi Garcia. but
both in the same ballpark.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't really think the need is offensive. So no. Yeah. All right, let's get to some listener questions before we get on out of here. Eric Thurlow has our first question. He says, with Franchi continuing to hit well, a call-up may be warranted soon. He doesn't really plug the hole in center field, but Verdugo could slide over. Is there any chance this delays Duran's call-up if Franchi can hit well when he's up?
I'm good.
He is crushing the ball, though.
Yeah, he is, I suppose. No, I don't think it would delay it because I don't see him as an everyday outfielder anyway. I'd rather have Verdugo and Renfro and then Duran out there as the everyday, and maybe he could be the fourth outfielder if he's hitting okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can bring up both, to be honest. I think that both would fit on this roster because I think that both – I don't think that Franchi would be worse than Danny Santana. So I think you could potentially have both on this roster at the same time. I don't know what you think about that.
Yep, I do. I agree.
Yeah. All right. Next one comes from Mike Parker. He says, what does Tristan Casas need to do to get promoted to Worcester? It feels like this move is as delayed as Duran, referencing Duran's promotion to Boston.
That's a good question. I mean, just keep killing it. They might be like the corresponding moves, I suppose. Like slide Duran up to the majors and then promote Casas. I mean, I guess there's... I don't know. Just keep doing what he's doing, I suppose.
I think he needs to probably work on his strikeouts a little bit. That's still been one of the things that he's probably doing a little bit too much. At the minor league level, if he can get those strikeouts down to like around 20% or lower, I feel like they'll have no choice because when he does make contact, he crushes the ball. And I think that's what they want to see from Casas is more consistent contact. So that would be my guess.
Yeah, I don't think the strikeouts are all that bad, though. I mean, right, he's at 25% right now, but for his style of hitting, that's not outrageous. We can live with that.
No, it's not. It's definitely not outrageous. I agree. The next question comes from Basic Braids, and he says, thoughts about giving the backup more playing time to ease the load off Vasquez? You're the catcher guy, Keaton. How do you feel about this?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with giving some more time to Pawlecki. I don't know about Wong yet.
Yeah, you probably want to lean on Vasquez while Wong is in there.
Yeah. I mean, but Pawlecki's been a nice little player when he's in there. So, yeah, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I really love Pawlecki, too. I feel totally comfortable with him behind the plate, calling the game and from an offensive standpoint. So, yeah, I think it's a great idea to try and keep Vasquez more fresh. But, you know, he is such a big part of what the Red Sox do, and I know a lot of guys are comfortable throwing to him. So, I think that kind of dictates his usage a little bit, but yeah, I think
you're taking a lot of speed off the bases, though, taking him out of the line.
That's right, Vasky the burner. And the final question of the night comes from the big man, and he says, "Do you think the GM has some secret info that stops him from bringing Duran up?"
No.
What do you think it is that is holding him back?
I don't know. Just that teams are stingy with good prospects. But they're already past the they're well past the gaining an extra year of control. And my frustration is just seeing the black hole that leadoff has been. And like, I'd rather see Duran out there than a revolving door of Kike, Marwin, JD Martinez every now and then. I don't think that there is a legitimate reason for him not to be playing for this team right now.
I think there is something to the fact that Worcester does play like a launching pad with the wind there. So his stats are probably a little bit inflated. And he definitely does still need to work on his defense a little bit more. I wonder if they're looking at some situational hitting things, you know, how he's doing against different handedness and in different counts and things like that that don't necessarily always show up in the box score. When you see at the end of the night, like, oh, you know, Duran went, you know, two for four with a bomb. You know, you look at that and you're thinking like, oh, all right, yeah, just bring him up. But the team might be looking at that and they might be saying like, oh, well, the two strikeouts, you know, both came against a lefty and in this particular situation. So it could be something like that that is just still holding them back a little bit.
Could be.
Could be. All right. That has been our show. It has been a little bit of a long one, but I hope you guys got some enjoyment out of the more thorough trade targets version of this show. If you enjoyed both myself and Keaton, you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow Keaton at The Spoken Keats. You can follow me at DevJake. You can follow the Over the Monster account at Over the Monster. And we thank you for joining us, making us part of your routine. And be sure to check out the other shows on our network as well. The Red Sox On Deck podcast, the Over the Monster podcast, and the Precap podcast. Thanks very much, and we'll be with you again next week.